saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. We are wrapping up our Silver Age conversations here at the end of 2024. This episode is our second to last issue review when it comes to Silver Age content, and it's a book that came out last year, so there we go. We're going to be reviewing Christos Gage and Greg Land's book, Original X-Men Number 1, which was a one-shot celebrating the 65th anniversary of the X-Men. We'll talk about that in the latter half. It's a continuity dense crazy issue. Welcome to the incredible Glenn Herdling for the first time. Welcome to my friend Brent Wingate and my friend Frank Moran, both coming back to Grey Malkin Lane as well. Let me have you each introduce yourselves with your name and pronouns. Let us know a little bit of your bio, and then I've got a question for each one of you after you finish your introductions. Let's begin with the incredible Glenn Herdling. Glenn, welcome to Grey Malkin Lane.
Thank you very much, Chad. My name is Glenn Herdling. I was an editor at Marvel Comics from 1986 to 1996, and also a writer, and my pronouns are he, him.
Okay, so we're going to begin in dense continuity. Try to keep it to three sentences or less. Glenn, can you tell me what a Phoenix Force is?
A Phoenix Force is something that overtakes you when you are down and out.
Oh, it sounds like a self-help program. Excellent. Let me welcome Frank Moran back to the show as well. Hi, Frank.
Hey, Chad. Excited to be back. Frank Moran, he, him, a character coordinator on X-Men 97. Basically, I just work with our lead artist, character designers. Based on what the writers have written us and provided us, we design all the characters that were needed in any of the episodes you see.
There is so much good stuff in that show, and I'm sad we're waiting so long for the second season, but great to
have you back.
Great to have you back. In just a few sentences, if possible, Frank, tell me what an Onslaught is.
So when you take two great tastes that taste great together, like a Professor Xavier and a Magneto, and you mash them together, you get this psychic entity known as Onslaught.
You get a rage baby, an astral rage baby. Let me also welcome Brent Wingate back to the show. Hi, Brent.
I'm Brent Wingate. My pronouns are he, him. I'm from the Poma Superior podcast. Each week we talk about X-Men and the MCU. It's a lot of fun. It's great. As a member of the podcast, I'm the one who needs desperately to be loved by everyone. That's my basic character trait.
Let me ask you in a few sentences or less, what is a phalanx, Brent?
A phalanx, thank you for finally asking. A phalanx is a organization of soldiers that you would use to fight an oncoming force where you're able to multiply your strength by unifying and getting tight together with your shield work.
Wow. We somehow left the trans mode out of all that, but I think it works. X-Men continuity is crazy, and we love the soap opera and the time travel and the nuttiness, but once in a while there's a concept that's used a little too much and it's a little too hard on our brains, and today's issue has some of that. I'm going to give you each one more question just for shits and giggles. Glenn, what is the familial relationship between Jermaine Chardos and Graydon Creed?
Oh my God. I have no idea.
So Mystique is the biological mother of Graydon Creed and of Nightcrawler, and Nightcrawler's adopted sister is Jermaine Chardos. Brent, what is the familial relationship between the Red Queen and Rachel Summers?
So here's the thing, Chad. I see what you're doing, and I'm sickened by it. Chad knows. He knows that on the podcast, I am not the expert on anything in X-Men history. What he's done is a bait and switch. I thought I was here to talk about some BS original X-Men characters pulled in and out of time whenever writers need to, and instead I'm getting quizzed. You tell me.
So
Brent, you need a phalanx right now?
Yeah, I could use it like 8 or 9. Please. I would love a hive mind to help me with this one.
So Cyclops and Jean love each other. Madeline Pryor is Jean's clone, right? And they have baby Cable together. Rachel is their daughter from another reality. Not Scott and Madeline, but Scott and Jean. And the Red Queen is an alternate Jean Grey who poses as Madeline Pryor in the 616.
My God.
I'm really glad I didn't try on that one because I would have given an answer that included Kate Pryde.
Frank, could you tell us the relationship between Wiccan and Wonder Man?
Ooh, I mean, Wiccan's son of Scarlet Witch, who's married to the Vision, whose brain patterns were based on Simon Williams.
Well done. What does that make them?
I guess he's an uncle? I guess uncle, cousin, yeah, uncle, nephew?
This is what the first removed means when you say like a cousin or a niece, you know.
In italics. So the latter half of today's going to jump into some crazy X-Men continuity. And it's always a big ask to ask people to read one in advance, but this was a crazy one. So Glenn, thanks for taking a jump into 2024 circa 1963 with us today.
Absolutely. Yeah.
When I was in New York City for New York Comic Con, my dear friend Gregory Wright invited me to a Marvel alumni party. I had so much fun meeting people whose names I've seen in 100 million comic books over the years. I get to invite some of them on the show. So I'm so happy you're here today. It was great to meet you.
Yeah, Greg and I will probably nowadays have more in common when it comes to beer than it does with comic books. But Greg and I had a great time back when I was, like I said, I was an editor from 86 to 96 with various responsibilities in between. And I also did some writing. And I probably caused some of those continuity explosions that we've seen today. For example, I wrote Namor for 2 years, Marvel's first and mightiest mutant, right? And I gave him a pseudo son. Wasn't really a son. It was a kind of a pseudo son that he had through Lyra. And but Lyra actually, as my friend Chris Cooper likes to remind me, Lyra raped Namor. I say, yes, she had a son through him, but then gave him her own mind. Lyran was his name, became king of Atlantis for a while. So I look now, and now I see there's even more familial relationships than Namor, and I'm trying to figure out where they do, because John Byrne had established way back when that Namor, he was a hybrid, that he was not actually able to reproduce. So now he does have some genetic children or whatever you want to call them out there. I'm not exactly sure how they do. I was actually able to explain Lyran. I'm not sure how his other relationships are now being able to explain.
I was going to tie this exact thing in a few minutes. Let's bring it up now. Namor the Submariner is the world's first mutant, right? Quote unquote. He does have more than one child. We do have the trial of Namor out on my show. Back when I used to work for the Marvel Handbooks, one of my areas of expertise was Namor. I love the old Namor comics. I love his crazy continuity. And there's some really wonky stuff that happens with him in the 80s and early 90s, including Atlantis Rising, which is one of the most brain-hurdy stories I've ever read in Marvel comics. Because the art is so huge and it's almost difficult to figure out what's going on. Lyran is the Namor child that's basically comes across as a clone of Namor, except he's painted green. I assume he's very happily working in some sort of gay club somewhere at this point. His ankle wings. And his mother, Lyra, is one of Marvel's most like real housewifey soap opera supervillains in Marvel history. Can't wait to do an episode on her one day. Do you want to begin there? What was it like for you to jump into the craziness of Namor, and how did you shift from editorial into writing at that
point? Well, I was still an editor at the time. It was actually Mike Rockowitz had asked me to do a proposal for Doc Strange, which he was editing at the time. So, and his version of the story and mine are completely different. So you can ask him what his version is, but he had asked me to do a proposal for Doctor Strange. I said, sure, absolutely, no problem. So like within like a week, I had given him a proposal for Doc, and as I hand it to him, he looks at me and he goes, what's this? I said, it's the proposal for Doc Strange that you asked for. He goes, I'm not editing Doc anymore. I'm like, oh, but I am editing Namor. Can you give me a proposal for that? He says, in fact, don't even give me a proposal. I just need a plot on my desk tomorrow. So my first episode, my first issue was called The Rime of the Ancient Submariner, which was based on the Samuel Coleridge poem from way back when, because I said I needed something that would give me 30 days kind of leeway to get myself up to speed on what's going on with the character. I was a huge Hulk fan growing up, but I was not really a Submariner fan. I would read the Tales to Astonish, or actually the reprints of the Marvel superheroes. I would read just the Hulk stories. I really wasn't interested in the Submariner stories. So now I had to actually get myself up to speed on what it is with, and this character had the most continuity in any any character of Marvel since he went back to World War II with Captain America. So I had a lot of catching up to do.
There's a lot going on with Namor during this time. First of all, he's drawn so hot. He's so muscly all the time, which is really fun. This is his kind of like Jay Lee era. This is like where John Byrne has like had him launch Oracle International. Namor's in the public consciousness in a way as mostly a Fantastic Four character, but he really does have his own wide lexicon of Marvel characters through this time as well. You involve a lot of really fun fan favorites from Tiger Shark to Stingray, and you really play in that sandbox quite well. How was it received at the time, writing Namor?
I think a lot of people were actually, because they didn't know what to expect, right? It was the first time I had been given, you know, a full series to write, and I'm coming off the heels of John Byrne and then Bob Harris and Jay Lee did their, you know, like Tolkien kind of, you know, take on Namor. They didn't even really tap into what Byrne was doing. They had a whole thing that was going on in Atlantis. So then I got saddled with resolving some of the plot threads that Byrne had left. And he left a lot of plot threads. And
he sure did.
Yeah. And he didn't give any hints as to, all right, here's what I was doing, right? So I was like, all right, how am I going to resolve this? And because, you know, like yourself, Chad, I was also a child of the Marvel Universe Handbook. I was one of my first writing gigs at Marvel. Mark Gruenwald tapped me to write that because he knew that I was really heavily into research. And so I did a lot of research into these characters. We had a time, it was something called the Saga of the Submariner, which was published, which was very helpful at the time. I got to read that and, you know, understand what the character a little bit more.
It's a great book. The Saga of the Submariner is great.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. You know, and so, and I based that because I wrote the saga, the Spider-Man saga at the same time that was going on. So that, because I was the assistant editor on Spider-Man, and Jim Salicrub, and, you know, asked me to write this because, again, he knew I was very heavily into research. So, you know, I love research. I love continuity, which is why this broadcast is going to be very interesting, because I do not know where continuity has gone. I think continuity has exploded. I feel really sorry for anyone who has to now write in the Marvel Universe, and I feel sorry if I had anything to do with
it. You know, the crazy part of continuity nowadays, though, is it's never been easier. There's more of it, but we got the internet and databases, and like the content is so much easier to access. Back when I worked on the handbooks, I had like 20 billion comic books, you know, just spread about my red room. But oh, a lot of things are digital, and it's so much easier to access and resource and connect. I would love to talk to you, if you'll step back just a little bit, how did you go from Marvel fan to Marvel editor? If you'll start with that part of your origin.
Well, so I went to Bucknell University, and my first night at Bucknell University, I had done a comic book with all my friends from home in it. And so I was actually coloring the cover of it. I was going to post it on my, you know, bulletin board, just so I always had a reminder of my friends. I'd given them all superpowers and everything. It was called the Ultra 10. One of our hallmates came in, and he looked, he goes, oh, you're into comic books too, I see. I said, yeah. And he goes, oh, my roommate's really into comic books. I'm like, oh, okay. He goes, yeah, he's really a good artist. I'm like, oh yeah, right. Okay. So he goes back, and then he brings me some of his artwork. I was like, oh my God, this stuff is really good. And I was almost ashamed of what I put mine away, and I said, I got to meet this guy. Well, it turns out that gentleman was Scott McDaniel. Scott McDaniel did some work on Daredevil. He did the Green Goblin. He did a lot of Superman work. I like to take credit for actually bringing him into Marvel at the time. We had sent a proposal to Marvel. Unfortunately, we didn't have the handbook at the time, so we did a story with the X-Men. Scott was very fluent with the X-Men. He loved the John Byrne. In fact, his style at the time was very reminiscent of Byrne, and so he knew them very well, but we needed a bad guy, and we were going to use Dr. Doom, but we didn't have any reference at our hands for Dr. Doom, so we used Darth Vader instead. So we sent this in. Meanwhile, I get an internship at Marvel, and and I get to know Elliot Brown. Elliot Brown was the submissions editor at the time.
I've had Elliot on the show a couple of times. Great.
Yeah, he's an awesome guy. He's fantastic. And so he was, you can imagine him as a submissions editor, right? He, pulled no punches. So
I'd rather not.
Yeah. So by the time I get back to Bucknell, I've known these guys. I got my foot in the door there and everything. I get a rejection letter from Elliot. And he obviously had sent the rejection letter before he got to know me. So then I sent him back a rejection letter on official Marvel letterhead, because I stole a bunch of letterhead when I was there. I sent him a rejection letter of his rejection letter. So that was pretty much my foot in the door when I was actually the intern for Carl Potts at the time. Jim Shooter's what they call an editorial assistant at the time. And then Jim Salicrup hired me very soon after that. And I became the assistant editor on the Spider-Man titles, which I was there for 2 years. We had a blast.
When you were working on Namor, you got to work with the incredible penciler Jeff Isherwood. I know there were a few others mixed in, but Jeff's pencils are gorgeous. Do you want to talk a little bit about Jeff's work?
Yeah, Jeff has never gotten the credit that he deserves. I don't understand why. Not only is Jeff just an amazing artist, but he is on time. He actually gets his work done on time. Not only you have this beautiful artwork, but you're not waiting for it. It's there. And he's such a professional. He's just so great to talk to. And he's got a lot of creative ideas. And I loved speaking with him about what we're going to do the next time. I take the Peter David approach to writing. I like having the artist inspired too. I just don't want to say, I'm going to write this and the artist is going, no, I want to know, what is it you want to draw this month, Jeff? What is, and Jeff is just, an amazing person.
What's, Glenn, I have a question. What if Wolverine met Conan the Barbarian?
What if?
That's one of your craziest works at Marvel, is this bizarre, Hyborian age version of Wolverine.
Yeah, and it was actually one of the first things I ever wrote. And Craig Anderson, took the idea. He was actually editing Conan at the time. And actually, the Conan properties, they were, Robert E. Howard properties, they were actually looking. They wanted to have more Conan. So when I pitched him the idea, he said, this is a great idea. Let's go with it. I, tapped into an old classic story that was done by Roy Thomas and featuring Red Sonja. I thought it would be great since, Wolverine had he had this kind of love of, relationship with Jean, and you have Red Sonja there, the red hair and everything. It kind of melded them all together and said, okay, now he's in the, Hyborian age, and he meets Red Sonja, who is his, warrior, which, Logan loves, warrior women too. So I thought it was just perfect, for a perfect place for him to be in.
Frank, any ideas on the craziest Wolverine?
I mean, for me, it is always, once he had the adamantium ripped out of him after Fatal Attractions, and then devolved into just like the feral state where he lost his nose. I never quite understood why losing his adamantium would have just made him lose his nose as well.
Yeah, I never understood that, and the whole nose.
And Brent, do you have one in mind?
Yeah, so mine is not from an X-Men comic per se. Sometimes I think creators want to set the North Star. Here's the direction this character is going to go. And they give you some kind of crazy endpoint that other artists can fill in the details later. But in Thor number one, there was an insane endpoint that was created where Old Man God Phoenix Wolverine shows up, and he is decked out with the power of the Phoenix Force and all these mystical elements, and you just think, why this character? Why did he make it to the end? Why are you doing any of this to us? This is insane.
I've explored some alternate Wolverines on my show recently. Two I haven't brought up. From Kitty's Fairy Tale, there's the Wolverine one, a little burly fairy tale villain version of him. And in Guardians of the Galaxy, there's a future daughter of Wolverine named Rancor, who's dressed in the sluttiest club uniform you've ever seen. It's really fantastic. Marvel loves to latch onto different properties. There's some weird ones over their years. Conan is one that kind of comes in and out. Glenn, fast forward a few years. You haven't kept track of continuity. Marvel had Conan's publishing rights again over the last several years. And there's a long storyline called the Savage Avengers, where Conan is a member of a team of Marvel heroes and interacts with characters like Wolverine. We, of course, have the Coolangath stuff that Claremont does with those properties as well. But then we get things like X-Men, Star Trek, or the way things, interface. A lot of this stuff gets forgotten too, right? A lot of people these days don't know about MC2 or the new universe. And some of your career interfaces with some of those corners of the Marvel universe people don't ever think about. Do you want to talk a little about Ultra Force?
Yeah. So I was also tasked, again, because Mark Moonwald always, you know, knew that I did my research. I delved into things. And so when we were, you know, we had acquired Malibu at the time, we were trying to make Malibu a more valued franchise. And
make Malibu Valibu again.
Yeah, right. So we tried to, you know, what we were trying to do was bring them, you know, have these crossovers in. And we had the Rune Silver Surfer, which I wrote. And we also had the Avengers Ultra Force. Now, I was writing some of the Avengers at the time. I did some, you know, I was actually tasked as the regular fill-in for Bob Harris. When I did, I also was doing the Avengers Unplugged. So when Mark Grunewald, when this came across his desk, he said, Glenn, I want you to do the Avengers Ultra Force, knowing that I would go in there, do my due diligence, read all the Ultra Force comic books and know who the characters were so we could bring them all together and have a lot of fun with them. And it was a lot of fun. I had a great time. Probably more fun though was the Rune Silver Surfer, because I was writing it, and a lot of times when you're writing a book, you don't know who the artist is going to be. So I'm writing it without understanding who it's going to be. And then once I submitted it, they told me, said, well, Glenn, we're not sure, you know, who we're going to. And I had been saddled with some people that I wasn't really very happy with, and you know, that during the time. And then they said, yeah, we're going to get John Buscema to do this. I was like, it was fun.
Now, for X-Men fans, this is the era of Nightman, Gambit, and also the all-new Exile series, where Juggernaut, Reaper, and Sienna Blaze went into the Ultraverse, and a girl there got the Phoenix Force for a while. There's some crazy continuity for X-Men fans. Tell everybody what Black Wolf is.
Well, Black Wolf will take more than a podcast to explain. Black Wolf was sort of our response to the Image universe. It was actually the brainchild of Ralph Macchio. What he wanted to do was he wanted to create something that would be sensational, that would exist within the Marvel universe, but did not need to rely on Marvel continuity. He wanted to create this kind of the subsection. So he figured the best way to do this would be go into the Eternals realm and actually use the Deviants. And so when he tasked me to write, he wanted me to do it because I had done some Daredevil fill-ins for him, and he saw my work on the Avengers, and he, you know, really liked, you know, my work at the time. So he said, you know, hey, I really want to do this. He had based it on Greek mythology, you know, on there was a character called Tantalus, and he wanted to, you know, base it on that. And so I kind of just took that and ran with it and made it even more mythological, mythos really that was going on. What we decided to do was, like, you know, every species, you cannot judge a species by its evil or good, right? Every species has its good people and its bad people, or its good beings and its bad beings. So the Deviants had always been portrayed as these evil beings, you know, these evil opponents to the Eternals. And we were just like, aren't there some good ones that would be opposed to what their mission was? So we created this whole line of beings who were actually good Deviants. And we were trying to make, you know, it was sort of like an X-Men kind of thing. It was a, you know, offshoot of the Marvel Universe that, you know, people didn't know what was going on at the time, but they were there, and we called them the Underground, and Black Wolf was, you know, ultimately became the leader.
When we used to do the handbook stuff, there was kind of a litmus test. You'd be like, okay, how obscure could you have access to? And people would be like, oh, I know Machine Man and Sleepwalker. And we're like, yeah, but do you know Black Wolf? Do you have Avengers Unplugged #4? Is that a space you're prepared to go? So Mark Grunewald and Peter Sanderson and Elliot Brown and others talked about this story on the show a little bit. They camp out at the Marvel offices and they make the first set of Marvel encyclopedias. It was a huge hit. A few years later, they're coming back and they're doing the Master Edition, right? It's one of the first major updates. I was involved in multiple updates in the early 2000s. Frank, are you a fan of the official handbook of the Marvel Universe?
How could you not be? I mean, that was right in the wheelhouse when I was a kid. Just hit that sweet spot. It gives you all, like, the nitty gritty and the quantification that you would want on your favorite heroes and villains. Plus, when you see, like, Elliot Brown's, like, drawings and schematics for stuff, like, I believe that I could build a web shooter. I believe that was a possibility. Like, oh, I could absolutely design one of my own. I just can just follow what the schematics are. This is right. Yeah. Amazing. I love those books so much.
Do you want to share a little bit about working with Mark and what it was like to work on the handbooks at the time?
At the handbooks, I didn't really interact with Mark too much on the handbooks. He had a full editor at the time under him. So I was doing most of my work with them. But again, Mark just appreciated, he appreciated the research that I did. Because Mark was the Marvel continuity. You know, there's a reason why, you know, he is the time cop of the Marvel universe, right? He is, you know, and he really appreciated the research that I did. Even when I created the Blood Wraith, for one, you know, for example, you know, when we were doing a Marvel annual and they were trying to come up with different characters, they wanted to create new characters. So I came up with that character, and he loved how I tied it into a character, Sean Dolan, who had not been seen for years. You know, Bob Harris never, ever said, whatever happened to this? Or, you know, these people that were in the Black Knight's lives for so long, and suddenly, you know, now he's doing this whole Avengers series, and he made the Black Knight his, you know, he was pretty much the team leader at the time, and yet he never went into whatever happened to these characters. So I went into them, I brought them back, and actually made the Black Knight Squire his number one enemy. And
yeah,
so,
the Blood Wraith. I wrote that entry in the handbooks.
Yeah. So yeah, it was, you know, so he loved what I did. Now, as far as the real Mark Nolan, you know, as far as that I knew, he was just, we loved each other because we had the same type of humor. We loved playing practical jokes. And I mean, I could give you many, many practical jokes that we were responsible for. One of the things, we went to on a ski trip, and Mark wanted me to pretend to cut off his ponytail, his, you know, beloved ponytail that he had. So I did that, and it was just me and Fabian Nicieza and a few other, I think Ralph Macchio and Pat Garrahy were there. And so he asked me, he had actually had a former ponytail that he had. And he said, I want you to take this, and then I want you to tell everyone that you cut my ponytail off. I said, sure, Mark, I'll do that. So I went in, and, you know, that morning I said, I'm going to cut off Mark's ponytail when he's asleep. So he was pretending to be asleep. Everyone else was awake. So I snuck in there. I took the scissors. I showed them all, and I took it off. And I came out, and I held it up, and they're like, oh my God, oh my God. Fabian said, you are so fired. You are so fired. Turned out just a practical joke. When he found out, oh, it was just, you know, everyone's like, oh, you guys got us. We went, I don't know, it was a year, maybe 2 years later, we went on an editorial retreat. Mark called me the night before the editorial retreat, and he says, Glenn, you know how you cut my ponytail off? You know, I said, yeah, I know the joke, Mark. He said, well, I want you to do it on this editorial retreat. I said, Mark, everyone knows the joke. Everyone, you know, they know it. Why, this wouldn't be funny? He goes, no, this time I want you to really do it. Oh, okay. So we all, you know, had these retreats, and we're talking about the continuity, and we're talking about what we're going to do with the following year, and what could be our big crossover and everything. Then at the end of the day, we're just having a good time. We all kind of get to sit and relax. We have a happy hour, and we're playing. You guys remember the game Thumper?
Mm-mm.
Thumper was an old drinking game that, you know, you can play, and you all have a signal, and you have to, you know, do your signal first. So my signal might be,
yes,
you know, tugging my ear. You know it, Brent?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
You tug in the ear, but then you have to do the other person's signal, you know, so it might be twitching your nose. So mine might be tugging the ear, Brent's was, you know, nose. So I'd be thumping, do that, and then I do. And then you have to go around. Everyone has to do different signals to each other, and, you know, and if you screw up, you drink. So we had a bunch of people at this table, and people just kept getting eliminated and eliminated and eliminated till finally, we did not plan this, don't know how it happened, but it got down to me and Mark, and we were just playing this game. And so we're thumping, and finally I said, all right, this is the perfect time to throw the game. And I threw the game, and because the tension was so intense, when he won, everyone got together and went, yeah! And they were screaming, and they're, you know, giving him congratulations and high five. They actually lifted him in his chair. Everyone took him up, and they lifted him. Each one took, someone took, and they lifted him, and they're bopping him up and down. That's when I took out my scissors, and he's there, and he's completely helpless. And they're looking at me, and they're going, no, no, no. And people are going, no, he's not going to. And I took it, right? And he's helpless. There's no way. And this could not have worked out any better. And I'm cutting through his actual ponytail. Got the ponytail. Everything goes silent. Everything is dead. And they're like, oh my God. And I'm running around like it's a trophy. It's like dead silent. I don't know. Everyone just seemed, the energies went out of the room, and everyone think they just went to sleep. I woke up the next morning. Tom DeFalco calls me into, you know, the side. He goes, I heard what you did to Mark, and I don't think it's very funny at all. Now, Tom has a very good poker face, so I can't tell, because I'm always afraid that a practical joke is going to turn on you, and maybe he had talked to Mark. So I'm like, all right, Tom. So I'm looking at him, and I said, do you know? And he goes, do I know what? And I said, you know that Mark and I planned this, right? And he goes, because he had originally told me, I want to see you in my office on Monday morning. And then he goes, all right, I want to see both of you in my office on Monday morning. So it was great. And at the end of the retreat, because still no one else knew that it had been a setup, Tom said, guys, what we really got to do here at Marvel, one of the things we really have to do is we got to show that we're still having fun. We've got to show everyone that this is a fun place to be. For example, I just want you all to know that you have been had by two of the best. Mark and Glenn, would you please stand up? And they all, everyone around was like, what, you assholes? That was planned, you And that's how we ended the retreat. But it was, you know, it was phenomenal.
What a fun and fantastic story. I love, and you know, meeting some of your contemporaries during that time, and even being at that alumni party recently, I could tell you guys are all still buddies and you have a really good time together. And what a wonderful thing. Can I ask you, what were the circumstances under which you left Marvel? And you could pass on that if you like.
No, it was, I had survived three rounds of layoffs. You know, that was when, you know, Ron Perlman, you know, they just didn't understand, you know, when Perlman's group bought us and when we were, you know, working for Revlon and everything. They just didn't understand that, you know, there was a ceiling that people would accept for how much you put out and how much crap you put out, right? Because what happened, the fans loved Marvel so much that they wanted to understand the entire universe. They wanted to understand. That's why the Marvel Universe handbooks, going back to that, were so popular, right? Because you could actually look up, oh, let me understand a little bit more about this character. You saw a character you didn't know in Marvel Team Up, or a character appears and, you know, the Hulk or something like that. Like, who is this character? You could look them up. So you got a taste of the entire story. Fans wanted to know the whole story. But when they found that they could not read the, and they could not understand the entire story, they were putting out so much, let's face it, crap at the time, that they just stopped buying altogether. So they didn't want to just, you know, buy a few things here and there, they just stopped altogether. And that's when the ceiling fell out. And that's when we had the glut, right? And that's where everything just kind of hit the fan. So, but I survived 3 years. I saw a lot of great people go. So a lot of people let go. People who were passionate about their job. People who, to no fault of their own, they were doing their job so well. Everyone loved their jobs. Everyone did it creatively. And yet it was these choices that were from on high that they had nothing to do, that they were now suffering because. And I saw that. For 3 years, and I was in custom publishing at the time, so my job was not actually in jeopardy. I was the only one doing what I was doing, but I was given the opportunity by Jean Scrocco. She was the agent for the Hildebrandt brothers. We were really good friends at the time, and we had done some work together, and she had asked me, you know, Glenn, would you like to come work for me? And when she gave me, I said, wow. So I get to fill two of my fantasies. I worked at Marvel Comics, and now I get to work with the legendary Hildebrandt brothers. Oh my God, yes. And I took her offer and did not look back. And
I look forward to having you back on another time, because I have a dozen more questions I want to ask you just about different things. But what a joy to hear these nuggets from history and to just hear the joy you have in talking about them a lot. Let me ask each of you, we're going to transition in just a moment. What was, if I could get a one sentence reaction from each of you to the book we're about to review, Original X-Men number one by Christos Gage. Frank, do you want to start here? What were your thoughts on this book? How did it compare to the last time I had you on my show?
Before we transition, I just want to also give a shout out to Glenn for his work on Fastlane. That must have been an awesome experience. I, like Chad, a bazillion questions. So when someday I would love to hear all the stories about working on something like that, because what a cool project.
It was actually.
Original X-Men, compared to the Defenders issue, this is definitely more my jam. So I would say, to paraphrase Doctor Who, a nice timey-wimey adventure.
Well, if we can get in an extra comment about Glenn, I just want to say how important the end of that story is, because if he did not get the clearance from Tom that, hey, this was a joke, Glenn would have been canceled. His career would be ruined today. He would be known as Glenn the Ponytail Slicer. My reaction to this comic is it is a honestly good attempt at trying to reconcile a very, very messy story for the original X-Men. I like to bring them here and try and do stuff with them is fine. I don't understand what the point of it is, but as like a mental exercise, I like it.
It's a complex one. There's a lot of density mixed in here.
Continuity dense. And to me, again, because I'm not following everything nowadays, so having, you know, jumped in in here is like, all right, well, these old characters, I know who they are. Now they're, you know, interacting with these modern characters. I kind of know them, but you know, where I stand on multiverse stories in the comic universe is where I stand on multiverse stories in the cinematic universe. And I just think, you know, like in the latest Deadpool, they made a lot of fun of it. And I make a lot of fun of that. I just, why are we doing so much multiverse stories? Can't we just stick with our main universe?
I think a lot of multiverse stories give us reflections of our heroes in a different lens, right? It's fun to answer those questions about what might have been. Now, this particular issue, and I know Sarah Brunstad was the editor. I've had Sarah on the show a number of times. She's amazing. This was the 65th anniversary celebration of the original X-Men, and they're wanting to do a story. Now, Christos Gage is a great guy to tap for this. Christos Gage, I've had on the show as well. Incredible writer. He knows his continuity. He's a huge continuity nerd from the original X-Men stuff. The interesting thing about this issue for me is I would love to have seen it be a celebration of the Silver Age, to have them go back and do like a really in-depth Silver Age adventure. Instead, what this turns into, for those that haven't read it, spoilers, and I have interviewed Christos right before this book came out, it's the original X-Men being yanked into another timeline where the concepts of the Phoenix Force, which is introduced in the early 70s, and the concepts of Onslaught, which are introduced in the late 90s, are now like being pitted against our heroes in a world where everything went wrong. Now, the interesting piece is we do see these characters see darker reflections of themselves about what they might be capable of, but we also directly represent the crazy Brian Michael Bendis story from the 20-aughts, where the original X-Men come forward to the present and are confronted in the present world with what their older selves look like. They go back in the past at the end of that like 5-year adventure, have their memories erased, and right at the start of this, they have to go, oh, we're giving you those old memories back so that you could use them for this one adventure, and then at the end, we're going to delete them all again. It's just one of those kind of unnecessarily complex stories, but it's still really beautifully done, and the stakes are really high. It's intense.
For me, I'm always primed for a good, you know, I mean, as a fan of What If, Exiles, Multiverse of Marvel Comics is something I can easily buy on board to. That was not an issue, but it also just seemed a lot of mechanics to be able to take our original X-Men that had time traveled into for Brian Bendis to then use them for this. A little bit of convolution to make this work. And so I don't know if it was, you know, I mean, I guess we have to set the ingredients that they're the only original five X-Men that have ever time traveled into the future. So would be best capable of handling this particular mission.
Yeah. And also, how many other times have they time traveled and just had their memories erased? Glenn, I neglected to mention just in my time management here, you also wrote a run on Cable and an issue of Uncanny X-Men and an annual with Ian Churchill that are some of my favorites ever. Next time you come back, we'll talk about those more.
Thank you, Chad. Yeah,
but I'd be neglectful if I didn't mention them on the X-Men show. They're like, they talked about Black Wolf, but not Cable. But yeah, let's chat again another time about those.
Sure.
Okay, so this book is called Original X-Men Number 1. It's from February 2024. The writer is Christos Gage. The artist is Greg Land. Greg Land has an extensive X-Men history. He's drawn a lot of X-Men comics over the years. Jay Leiston is the inker. Frank D'Armata on colors. Clayton Cowell on letters. And Lindsay Kohek and Sarah Brunstad are the editors. We have a gorgeous Ryan Stegman cover on this book that is beautiful. Ryan is currently drawing the main X-Men title under Jed McKay. We feature Scott and Jean very, very prominently.
You know, the thing I like most about the cover is how much it looks like the Gray Malkin Lane font. You know, I don't know if you noticed that there's like a similarity here between these characters. As far as the cover goes, it really highlights the team in a powerful way. You see kind of an older, what kind of really feels like an older version of the characters than they're supposed to be, I think, in the issue. But it's like an updated look at their more classic original condom head wrap style.
The striations on Iceman's ice bridge, the texture to Angel's wings, the way the fabric fits the form. It's really beautiful. Beast is giving like very gargoyle in this, which is really beautifully done as well. Frank, did you have any thoughts on the cover?
I loved it. I mean, I've got a soft spot for these old school original five costumes. That was one of my big claim to fame for X-Men season one, was getting to be able to have the one picture that we have in Xavier's office of the original five in their original costumes, and putting Bobby in his snowman look as opposed to his kind of nice reflective sheeny ice look. So I do like that. At least it seems on the interior we get more Bobby in his snowman-esque form as opposed to here on the cover where it's more the crystalline version of him.
Yeah, absolutely. So this falls in the original continuity, and again, Christos Gage knows his stuff. Right when the first regime swap took place, when Stan Lee left the book and Roy Thomas took over, one of their very first adventures is Count Nefaria recruiting a group of crazy supervillains, Plant Man, Unicorn, Eel, and Porcupine, and taking over Washington, D.C. So this seems to be taking place right after that. The X-Men are sparring with Plant Man, who has, in my opinion, one of the best costumes in comics. Glenn, do you want to talk about Plant Man's costume? It's delightful.
it's just a plant, right?
It's like a carefully textured leaf costume.
It's kind of like a corn cob, right? If you're a corn, you know, the leaf, if you can peel it off like a corn, a piece of corn.
No, watch for a Plant Man Patreon episode on my show in January. I've been waiting to do this one for a while. I can't wait. Marcus Onasso and Philip Lindquist are joining me for that. It's going to be a good time. So the X-Men are fighting Plant Man. The opening caption lets us know this is a simpler time. He is threatening to blow up microscopic flora in their digestive tract to burst them like balloons, which is very scary. Iceman says, I'm never eating salad again. And Jean says, you don't eat salad now, Iceman, which is one of the best lines in the book. I think it's really fun. And then the X-Men get yanked out of time and Plant Man gets to go run off with the Eel to have further capers. I think they go join the crime wave after this, an old Captain America book. And then we get yanked into a place that they identify as Elsewhere, Elsewhen. And who is there to greet them, Brent?
Well, it's one of our classic variations of the Phoenix, an out of time woman. The thing is, I don't love that Elsewhere and Elsewhen is just a generic place where you can always go. Sometimes it's not the white hot room. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's nowhere, no when. Just pick a location where everyone is meeting up. One coffee spot where we're all hanging out, doing our interdimensional cosmic business. Trying to be vague about it is just silly to me.
Marvel has a number of places that are like outside the time stream, right? Yeah. We can see that explored in the Loki series with the Time Variance Authority, where time still passes, but it's just the rules are different. It's fine. It gives us very Doctor Strange backgrounds. It's like very Steve Ditko somehow. Like we have a darker black and yellow version of the Phoenix here. Welcome, X-Men. Please forgive the abruptness of my summons. And then you can almost tell editorial just went back and added this later almost. The Cyclops says, Marvel Girl, is that you? Excuse me? She's ancient. Rude.
Yeah, she's like 20 years older than you at most. Chill. She did not need a bunch of teenagers to come to her and question how she looks. They're all dressed like they're about to go spelunking at the bottom of a river.
And then the Phoenix just basically says in a moment of passing, let me restore all of your memories from that time you time traveled. And Jean goes, ugh, Phoenix, I'm sick of you. It's her first statement after having her memories restored, which is delightful. Now, if you remember, when Jean time traveled to the present, she had a whole series where she's running from the Phoenix. She gets killed by the Phoenix, then she has to rebuild her body out of like stray cosmic matter. So teen Jean has a right to hate the Phoenix, even though she knows her adult self's future potential as well. We then see the Phoenix explaining some very complex plot lines here. You're all a bundle of hormones and nervous energy, so I'm gonna keep you still for a minute. Hear me out. And then if you still want me to, I'll send you home. I see you glaring at me, Jean. Never change. There's a lot of little nuggets here that I think are really great. She says, you're all thinking of the Phoenix from your timeline. That's not me. That Phoenix replaced Jean Grey, became unstable and committed mass murder. In my reality, it was different. The Phoenix once force asked me if it could bond with me. I said yes, and we came to a peaceful coexistence. Together, we helped bring peace to my world. Things are really quite nice there, but now there's a threat to the whole multiverse. Okay, so we have one alternate reality being introduced by this Phoenix force, saying she and Jean made the world a better place in her world. But now there's a different Phoenix threat in another world that she wants them to counter. Glenn, do you want to tell us what happened in this other world that the Phoenix is worried about?
Well, everything's going to hell in the other world, right? So, but my concern was in the first one, why would you trust that Phoenix, right? Why would you, you know, all right, okay, we believe you. You merged, you and Jean came to a conclusion that, you know, everything was great if you just merged your souls together and everything is great. And we're going to trust you to go into this other one where everything is. How do we know that that Phoenix isn't just trying to take over the other Phoenix? So, you know, so I didn't trust. I thought we were going to see some kind of, first of all, I didn't know that this is just going to be a one shot, right? So I thought we were going to go into multiple issues and everything. So I was like, oh, wow. You know, no, it's a single issue, which is great because you hardly ever see single issue stories anymore. So I love that. Yeah. So everything is, you know, hitting the fan in the other universe, but, and her universe is fine, but she just wants to make sure her universe is taken care of. So that's why she went and reached back to this other universe. So you have all these different different universes in one single story. I mean, kudos to the writer. Fantastic job in doing that in, you know, one
I mean,
story.
Yes, but also we're on page four.
Yeah.
I mean, I like your point, Glenn, but my question when we got to this was who put the Phoenix in charge of being the police of the Phoenix? What is this system set up where you are now responsible for every multiversal version of yourself? Right. It's absurd. Why are we? Hey, lady, you yanked me out of time. Why don't you go solve this problem?
So to reference continuity very quickly, when the time traveling X-Men came to the present, it's because Beast pulled them there because he wanted them to teach their older version of Cyclops, basically a lesson about like, dude, you just killed Xavier. What's wrong with you? Then they get trapped here for a long time. And then there's that group of time traveling X-Men from the future that call themselves the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants with the evil son of Charles Xavier. And it's all about deception. There's a Zorn, but it's really Jean Grey. And there's another character, but it's really the child of, like, I don't know, raise the child of Xavier and Mystique. The child of Wolverine and Mystique, excuse me. It's very complex. So these characters have a right to be very skeptical right away. And they agree to all of this very quickly. But basically the premise is there's a different world where there's a different Phoenix who has corrupted her world's X-Men. Jean Grey brought peace to this world by conquering it, she says. And it's very Mark Gruenwald's Squadron Supreme, right? Like where the heroes run the universe and here's the craziness that happens. Angel says, I have a healthy self-image, but I kind of think you're the better choice to stop this lady. And she says, no, she could just absorb my power. You are a shot because you literally are them, your younger selves. If you could go there and persuade your older selves to turn against Phoenix, then maybe she could like stop you. Also, let me tell you about the time that I defeated both the devil and Dormammu in the same day. This is a weird setup. It's a bizarre, bizarre journey. We then jump to how things progressed on the other world. Frank, do you want to tell us about early Jean and her decisions with Magneto and Charles Xavier?
Yeah, because I mean, I feel like this is like, as we're talking about a Silver Age homage. I mean, like that is kind of classic Silver Age where there's a lot that could be explained, but we're just kind of giving you the basic thing just to keep the plot just driving along. I can understand why there is a lot more that could be like, hey, wait a minute, how is this all working together? I can understand like for Silver Age brevity, we're just full steam ahead on this. But we see Jean once, based off a couple of Avengers issues where Magneto fought against both the X-Men and the Avengers. We do a twist on this world where he actually kills Xavier at the end of that. And Jean, taking a page from Charles in the far future in this, actually then it shuts down Magneto's mind, which, yes, we find out later is instead of Onslaught being Xavier and Magneto mashup, it is now a Jean and Magneto mashup.
Okay, so Onslaught in our world is the Xavier Magneto rage baby, but in this world, it's the Jean Magneto rage baby that develops from her killing Magneto. That's the surprise at the end of this issue. Now, also please reflect a deep continuity, Louise Simonson's Jean Grey series from a few years ago. This concept of Jean taking over the world, like letting her powers go, is explored really beautifully in that series and what the potential consequences are, the way she nudges her allies. So in this world, direct quote, Jean began calling herself Phoenix soon afterward, much earlier than in our timelines. I'm not sure if in horror at seeing the professor struck down, she called the Phoenix force that had watched her most of her life, or if it came in response to her throwing off the shackles of her power, it doesn't really matter. She and her fellow X-Men, heartsick over all the suffering and loss they'd seen, trying to realize Professor Xavier's dream, decided to continue using more divisive methods to bring peace between mutants and humankind. Those who hated and feared mutants abruptly changed their ways. We see Warren Worthington shaking hands with Robert Kelly. Look, you could run for president and mutants are still good people. We see Jean dismantling a bunch of Ultrons. We see Jean fighting Iron Man, and it turns out she like completely brainwashes him and makes him like subservient to the mutant kind. Then she starts branching into other worlds. We see her fighting Annihilus in the Negative Zone. We're now on like page six.
She defeats Annihilus, but also does a sponsorship deal with Beats Stereos, where she has to show off her cool dance moves to the power of the universe.
It is a good little bit. She's got the cosmic control rod in her hand, which gives major vibrator vibes, and she's just feeling herself like her sash is blowing in the wind. I totally get it. She warns younger Jean that the power of the Phoenix can be addictive. Maybe it's because Jean got it as a teen, and that's why she wasn't a full-fledged woman. Maybe that's why she went insane. And Beast says, I have a question, ma'am. Phoenix Force says, anything, Hank, as long as you stop calling me ma'am. If we die, won't it wreck our timeline? And she says, timelines are resilient. It should survive until she shows up to consume it. What are your thoughts on time travel science, Frank?
You know, I mean, I guess there's so many different theories, you know, like depending on, you know, what movie you want to ascribe to or novel, you know, or even later in the Team Weapon X, the Weapon X-Men series after this, where it's like, oh, yeah, we could go back in time, but it'll just make a divergent timeline. So,
right.
Yeah. So, you know, in the big multiverse, we'll just be in a new path where, you know, a different outcome would have happened.
Jean says, don't worry, your anchor being will be perfectly safe. So your timeline is going to be fine.
I don't even know what that means. Glad I've said this on the show a number of times. The worst part of working on the handbooks was keeping track of which reality had which number assigned to it. The worst.
Oh, yeah. That's, which Earth are we on? Which?
So now we are in the Earth that is in danger. The one where Jean and Magneto killed Magneto. It's called Earth 696. I don't even know why that's the number. It just is. Not 616, but 696. When they arrive, they basically are like, oh, it looks the same as our world. What plans should we make? And Brent, what do they decide to do?
So one of the things that I think this book does well is it does think about how people in the universe would think. So they basically set up a plan to confront their other versions of themselves, but they have to do it very carefully because any one of them could send a psychic tripwire that would make Jean come back and she would insta-kill them all. Step one is just try and find the most accessible, easy to take down mutant of their group. And they go for Bobby.
Why?
Oh, well, the power of homosexuality. Bobby was never really interested in Jean. And also, I guess he, in this version, would know that Jean is the one who outed him. So he would have a little bit of extra resentment and think, this is a good strategy.
Bobby says, it's got to be me because I'm the only one who never had a major crush on Jean. Like, okay. How do they find where Bobby lives? By picking up the Daily Bugle, where there's a headline that says lifestyles of the rich and sexy. Iceman's lets it go in $30 million penthouse. So if Iceman goes evil, if my Iceman breaks bad, Brent, what's the world like for him?
Well, I've got a different question, which is, this is a reference to Frozen, right? So like in this universe, Frozen was also written and everyone compares him to Elsa. Is this a good thing or a bad thing for here? I don't know.
I don't know. It's
I think if he goes bad, I think Iceman would, he would definitely go like evil queen for sure. Like you've got to have an entire building that is made out of ice or everything is crystal. All of it is see-through. There's nowhere to hide in his ice fortress.
He's giving me major, like, I don't know, Rock Hudson in the late 70s vibes. Yeah. He's got like this bachelor pad. You just know he has like 14 like sexy naked boys over to his pool every other day when he's not out like committing crimes. Nice Man's like, whoa, look at this great life that I have out here. Wow. It's a really bizarre version of Bobby, but I kind of get it. That part's a little bit magic. He comes across as like very devil may care in a lot of ways. Angel flies in, the teen Angel, and adult evil Bobby is like, oh, you're back from LA early. The West Coast X-Men run a tight ship out there, at least since Phoenix had her come to Genie meeting with Moon Knight. So in this world, Moon Knight runs the West Coast X-Men, which is weird. That's maybe the weirdest part of the issue.
See, I thought I missed something. So if you guys are telling me I didn't miss anything, then I'm glad, because I was like, wait a minute, is Moon Knight a mutant now? Is there something that I have not been made aware of? So I
just weird.
The one thing I did like, though, to go back to the Daily Bugle for a second, that as much as there in this universe, we're all going to promote the lifestyles of the rich and sexy, that J. Jonah is still making room on the front page to throw that picture of Spider-Man in. It's like, no.
Yeah.
This is a menace. This guy's still a menace, guys.
Now, in this world, Angel is some sort of fly-hang superhero villain who negotiates with the Magia and apparently is fucking Madame Mask, which is crazy. Frank, are you a fan of an Angel-Madame Mask hookup?
Not one I would have expected, you know? But I mean, I guess if Tony Stark is kind of, you know, not operating in all cylinders now after his encounter with Jean, you know, there's a vacuum there that Warren is able to go and slide in.
She loves an unethical billionaire. That's
right. Exactly, yeah.
Right. What I did like about this is of how well it treated. I feel like Angel's ability when he's not Archangel, but just regular, just plain old Angel, is always like, yeah, he just flies around. But I felt like this sequence really showed off like how crazy it could be still just to kind of fight a winged man and all his aerial abilities that he's got.
Yeah, so we have teen Bobby and teen Beast fighting adult Angel and adult Iceman.
This, basically everything goes wrong right away. It's typical for the teens. So adult Warren shows up and kind of spoils it all. So the jig is up, so to speak. So it is Hank trying to take care of Warren, which then leads to a great aerial kind of maneuvering, which ends up just, which I guess would make sense, make somebody incredibly motion sick. So always wanted to see young Hank McCoy vomit. And so checking that off my bucket list, thank goodness.
Yeah, it's a little bit graphic. There's like green splatter going everywhere. And then he yanks some feathers out of adult Angel's wings that make him crash, which is just fucking brutal, right? Like, let me pluck your flight feathers. I think those are called pin feathers or something. Adult Iceman has like a I'll freeze you to death energy. And we get this odd image of Jean like frozen with her like eyelashes frozen and like ice dripping down her face. She's like, I won't stop you, Bobby. You can kill me if you have to. And he's like, okay, fine. Let's talk.
Chad, I had a question for you.
Yeah.
With this version of Angel's costume, what do you think of the look? Because I always thought this one both looks very stylish, but also what if Marvel was actually a Christian company trying to create superheroes?
Little known fact, this costume was designed by Magneto. Angel crash landed in the Savage Land and he woke up and Magneto dressed him in this costume. There's a later story in the Silver Age where Magneto kidnaps Angel and puts this costume on and then poses as the Angel among the X-Men. Like, waha, I'm wearing the Halo costume. I actually really like this. It might be my favorite Angel costume of all time.
I love this costume. This is, yeah, this is my favorite Angel costume too.
Do you go the red version or the blue version?
I like this one. I like the blue version best.
I like the blue because it's kind of more within the X-Men colors. So yeah.
I didn't ask your thoughts on Greg Land's art.
I'm Greg Land. I don't know. Is my mileage varies with Greg Land. I mean, it is very serviceable. It does the story well, but yeah, at points the photo reference-y nature of some of his poses comes through, especially as Brent pointed out, Gene just dancing as Annihilus is down for the count there in the negative zone.
Just ridiculous. And did you have thoughts, Glenn? I don't know if you've worked with Greg Land before.
No, I haven't, but I've worked with a lot of people who have, and he's very well respected and people love. I love his stuff too. I did not envy him for this plot. I mean, there is, like you said, there's just so much going on to try to squeeze events that are going on into a single story. I think he did a great job. There are things that, where I think he did close-ups on things that shouldn't have been close-ups, and then things he did, he pulled back where he should have been, so I think there were, the shots, the angles that he chose, and sometimes I was like, why did you go that way? There were things, even in the very beginning when the characters disappeared, I didn't know they disappeared. I wasn't sure what was going on that panel. It was, they just kind of, you saw these walls of light. I was like, what happened? So there were certain things that I just thought could have been explained a little better, and if he chose a different angle or a different shot would have been done. But as far as the mechanics of it, I think are just wonderful given how much he had to put into this issue.
Yeah, the fight choreography is really fun through a lot of this. I agree. Yeah. Okay, so we jump to all of them sitting down. The people who got frozen are drinking hot cocoa. Angel's drying off and they're just talking things out. He's like, there's no way Jean is an evil cosmic sun eater. And she's like, actually, it's very true. And they're like, dude, you brainwash people. Like, what's wrong with you? And they're like, yeah, we only brainwash bigots, people who want mutants rounded up and exterminated. And Teen Bobby, and Brent, I'll hear your feedback here, if you will. Teen Bobby says, so you round them up and brainwash them? Or do you prefer conversion therapy, in quotes? What are your thoughts?
Well, okay, so Bobby makes a good point, and I think this point it's fair coming from Bobby especially. I think either he or Jean are the ones that really are the best to hammer this home, because for a queer person, the idea of conversion therapy is that you're able to take some kind of immutable characteristic and change it. And there's this belief that the X-Men have, at least, especially the original five at this time, there's a belief of the kind of Xavier Vision that you can change people's minds, that by being different, we do not force them into a new position. They embrace it themselves. And for someone like Jean, the thing that's always very interesting is knowing her past and the Phoenix Force and the things she does, she is one of the more interesting moral choices to say, hey, by the way, you have to be very careful about how you push people's mental states, and you can't just do it willy-nilly, because I think they realize in their heart of hearts that there's no way it was just the bigots and the monsters who were getting brainwashed. It was a lot more people, as we see, especially when you get to Tony Stark.
Well, and seeing teen Iceman say this to adult Iceman is an interesting thing. Conversion therapy is a fake premise that if we make you brainwash enough and like make you believe that something is broken in you, then you can fix it or change it, right? So if Xavier or Jean is like altering the data in your brain just a little bit and it makes you think differently, it's not actually changing the person. It's just making them believe something you want them to believe. So we get a moment where adult Angel, they're like, how did you get like this? And he says, you watch people you love suffer and die. You suffer yourself worse than you ever imagined was possible. You sacrifice everything to make things better. And not only do they not get better, it all gets worse. So one day you compromise just a little, just this once, then you do it again. After a while, you tell yourself it was for the best, the only way, and you actually believe it. Until your teenage self shows up, and all it takes is one look to see how much of a hypocrite sellout you are. Now, we'll talk about this at the end, but save your thoughts in this world post-election where we're feeling a little doom and gloomy and like we might want to sacrifice our ethics a little bit. This is a rousing speech in some ways. And they agree that they need to talk to older Jean and find out what is going on. We get some really fun moments. Warren Buddy says, Iceman, are you sure you want to do this? It's already done. And they say, we need to talk to Hank. Now, Frank, in this world, how has the world gone differently for Hank McCoy?
Yeah, he's certainly getting much more esteem in this one. So he's kind of able to use his mind. He's right up there along with Tony Stark. I mean, this, I was worried we were going to go down the typical road where he's going to be, where we almost invariably see Hank McCoy go down, where he becomes some kind of dark version of himself. Other than the Krakoa era, we saw that in the Age of Apocalypse timeline. So I was expecting, are we going to go down this route again? So I was refreshed to see that he's been having these same kind of similar feelings, especially after he's seen what's been going on with Tony Stark. And I do like that he's still in the gray fur. Great touch.
It's a savage version of Beast who seems to be less intelligent and more bestial, right? He's in his kind of gray form, which is the initial transformation, except even more monstrous. And in this world, he basically says Tony Stark has been harnessed, but because he doesn't have his creativity, all of his weapons no longer really work. So it also doesn't take Beast long to realize, oh yeah, maybe we've gone a little too far here. Maybe we're waking them up. There is now a visit to the Gray Summers residence. They've activated some old Sentinels in Australia. That's an old Roy Thomas Avengers story we talked about on my show earlier this year. To keep the Phoenix busy, they sit down with Scott and they're like, wait, you think she's a paranoid and unhinged? This is Jean we're talking about. Then they show him the original X-Men, but all of a sudden here is the Phoenix. She is looking like the same Phoenix that recruited the team, but this is the evil Phoenix from this world. Brett, do you think that Scott and Jean had a happy life in the Gray Summers mansion?
I can't say it was marital bliss. I did also clock that Angel looked like he reverted a little bit on his head cowl. But no, this feels like a much more hollowed out Scott, one that I'm not a huge fan of because I always like him having some moral turpitude. And so for him to kind of let this happen under his watch, it just feels very sad in a way that's not, it doesn't, I don't feel like there's an emotional itch that's being scratched here. It's just unfortunate.
This part of the story feels really rushed. So we have adult Warren, adult Hank, adult Bobby, convincing adult Scott that maybe adult Jean is evil. Adult Jean shows up and she says, I'm just going to wipe your minds and send you back and then I'll deal with everyone else, including that Phoenix lady who sent you here. That bitch, I'll come after her too. And teen Jean says, you're a liar. I'm not sure what, but you're not me. I think you're part of me. The dark thoughts I don't want to admit I have and something else, but not. And then adult Jean is like, shut up. The teenager, so much drama. Everything's a heart attack. Then adult Scott turns on adult Jean, who is his wife. And he's like, you know, you're not the woman I fell in love with. You're not her and I'm not him. And her response, Frank, is what?
She just pops him. Just like, see you later, Scott. You know, you were nice while you lasted.
Splat, bullet to the head. He explodes in optic energy somehow. It looks like his legs blow off. I don't know. It's quite, we get a shracked. It's quite violent. And then we flip the page and adult Jean morphs. Do you want to talk to us, Glenn, about the man that pops out of her?
Oh, God. that was the onslaught where it was like, you know, everyone becomes, which I thought was amazing, because I really like how they did the onslaught in this universe, and it was a fantastic drawing of onslaught. I just thought everything was very well done, but everything's just coming together, and it had, you know, you have the Phoenix emblem on the onslaught armor, so it was like, oh wow, everything is coming together. They're really reaching out to all different areas of the multiverse. For
Brent, is it a snicked or a kicked on the onslaught armor with Phoenix emblem on the chest?
Okay, I'm glad you asked, because the onslaught, his original costume is garbage. It is just trying to amp up the stuff that people liked about Magneto's look without understanding what made it so cool. This one tries to fix that, I think, in a unique way by making it have more of a feminine element. So the snicked here is that the stupid pointy shoulder pads have now become this kind of like almost like feather hood or like a shoulder kind of padding.
Yeah, it's, and like, it's like he's wearing like a metal fur coat almost.
Yes, exactly. And then he's got a waist that's cinched for the gods. The nails are on point. I think that this makes the outfit, which is still somewhat stupid, look a whole lot better.
And Beast is like, of course, it's Jean and Magneto made an onslaught. Why didn't we see it? Because it's stupid. That's why you didn't see it. What the
okay,
fuck is
so
happening in this
story? Do you think, because I kind of think that this story feels like a fun what if. What if Jean Grey wasn't manipulated mentally by Wingard? Instead, what if it was Onslaught? And you're like, oh, I kind of like that idea, but it feels like it's trying to be shoehorned into this other time travel story that's not necessary at all.
So in this world, there is no Phoenix Force. Jean Grey killed Magneto and they birthed the rage baby Onslaught, who recognizes he's not powerful enough to be a god, so he's posing as the Phoenix to intimidate gods while he starts killing beings and drawing power so that he can elevate himself to a cosmic level. He's now lashing out at the X-Men, we don't know. And Jean's like, I learned a trick on my planet where I can unite every human mind to repel you, which is a thing Xavier does with the Zadox in the Silver Age. And Onslaught's, yeah, I'll drain every mind, I'll just kill the whole world, so there. And suddenly he feels pain again. This is a bizarre little psychic battle between the two of them. It's very Xavier versus the Shadow King.
It's interesting because I guess the whole premise that Jean and Magneto's minds, you know, commingling would yield the same result that an Xavier Magneto collaboration would. So it feels weird that we would just get the exact same kind of onslaught. Because other than they're telepathic and Jean is also a telekinetic, you feel like it would be a different entity. But regardless, we ended up getting just a version of Onslaught. So, you know, I mean, I guess Christos does his due diligence in terms of continuity and knows that Jean in later first runs of the earlier issues of X-Men does do like a global wide uniting of people. So, and you know, he's dotted his I's and crossed his T's in terms of like how Jean could pull this off.
So Jean is manifesting the energy of everyone on the planet. Onslaught calls her a stupid girl. She's like, I made you and I have to undo you. And then the human aspect of adult Jean manifests itself and she's like, oh, now I'm not evil anymore, let me help you turn on Onslaught. But also she looks like the same Phoenix that we met on the first page. Oh, you guys, it's really cool.
Yeah, I don't know why we didn't color this Phoenix differently. That I think would have solved a lot of issues. Just give her a different costume color.
So Jean turns on Onslaught, who calls her a stupid cow.
Well, no, I'm glad you pointed out the stupid cow, because calling Jean Grey a cow is a very integral part of X-Men history. To me, it's so weird. All right, so the Onslaught entity was pretending to be a Phoenix, so basically committing Phoenix fraud, and the other universe's Phoenix assumed incorrectly, like, it was a multiversal trick to be the Phoenix. Why did the first Phoenix say, we got to stop this other Phoenix, not knowing that it's actually just Onslaught, when that own universe's Phoenix doesn't register Onslaught as a threat?
I don't know. But then all the X-Men join hands and they give the Onslaught a big Care Bear stare and the planet breaks in half. Well, goodbye, everybody.
I did not get that last panel. I was like, did the planet, it was his psychic entity exploding, or was the planet breaking apart? It wasn't until later I realized, oh, no, that was the planet going.
No, completely. Yeah, they sent the original X-Men there and the planet died. Like billions of people in
a universal astral explosion. Did they win? Did they save the day? Question mark. I mean, I suppose they stopped this from going to other realities. So the original X-Men get yanked back to elsewhere slash elsewhen, and the original Phoenix they met, there was nothing you could have done. Onslaught was too powerful. It was the only, and Beast goes, please just wipe our minds and send us home. And Angel goes, can we just fight Plant Man again? She says, I'm very sorry. And Teen Jean says, we understand it was necessary, but there's no reason we need to remember this. I don't want these memories back ever. I know you can give us that. In fact, it's the least you can do, which is so weird. Why would they choose to just not remember this crazy thing? Then we get a giant manifestation. The Phoenix will send you home. Just click your heels. There's no place back home. Thank you, my old friends, my old self. Take care of each other. Glenn, what are your thoughts on the resolution of this story before we get one last reveal on the final page?
No, that's exactly what I was thinking there, Chad, when I saw that. It's the Wizard of Oz. It's like, you know, you could just, you know, go home and this has never happened and you'll never have to worry about it. And you know, anytime you can do a mind wipe, if you had the choice to learn from your who you were or to mind wipe, at least Dorothy didn't get her mind wiped when she went home, right?
I mean... So we now jump to the final page where this version of Phoenix from another reality is not alone. Who is there with them, Frank?
Man, we got our boy, Wolverine from the Age of Apocalypse.
James Howlett of Earth 295. I'm not exactly sure where this man gets pulled from in continuity, but in the Age of Apocalypse, Cyclops blasted his hand off. This is one-handed Wolverine in black and red with the crazy hair, who in his world at some point becomes the Phoenix and becomes like the arch nemesis of his realm. That's a thing in continuity if you follow the Age of Apocalypse, post-Age of Apocalypse. This story then leads into another book called Weapon X-Men, which is a limited series by Christos Gage that follows this up, where it's a team of different Wolverines from different realities hopping around to stop Onslaught that they met here from destroying other worlds. We're not going to review that on this show, but this adventure.
Again, it just goes into that whole multiverse thing, and I was like, wait a minute, is this, you know, which Wolverine? And to your point, again, I was like, oh, right, that was from the Age of Apocalypse. I was, all right, wait, from what aspect of Age of Apocalypse was he pulled from? Where we, you know, how do we, you know, and then when I saw that down below that you said, you know, to be the Weapon X-Men series, I was like, oh no. And then I did read about, you know, later, you know, on the next page where they're talking about how there's going to be the variants of Wolverine. I'm like, no, not this again. No, not multiverse comics where there's multiple versions of everyone. Please stop it.
And Brent?
One of my favorite parts of any kind of story, especially ones that have sci-fi elements to it, is just leaving you with a, this is fucking up kind of feeling. And I think the thing that this story added was, in Jean's history, probably her most famous genocide is of the broccoli people. This story's only purpose is to add another planet of billions of people that she just blew up, but this one she requested to forget it. So she's just now got a higher kill list and no one remembers it.
There are a number of books out there with reality hopping mutants or heroes that I really love. Avengers Forever by Kurt Busiek with the Avengers from different timelines. Amazing. The original Exiles under Judd Winnick. Incredible. Dazzler in Extreme X-Men Volume 2, hopping around and killing evil Xaviers with her team of reality. Like, amazing. This one, there's nothing wrong with this issue. It's tightly packed. It's beautifully written. It's condensed and moves very, very quickly. I think if it was just a what if story of like, what if Jean had killed Magneto and we got to see that world, interesting. But the fact that it's the original X-Men with their brains wipe and Onslaught and double Phoenixes, and I really dislike it. It's rare for me to say that on this show. I respect everyone that made this book, but this issue is rough for me. I really love Christos Gage. I love Sarah Brunstad, but this issue was rough for me. I don't know. Do you guys have any kind of resonant thoughts or feelings or anything that just kind of stood out to you as we're wrapping up our conversation?
Well, I mean, I know this is like set up as just like a tease, essentially, for the Weapon X-Men series, which...
Yeah, let's celebrate the original X-Men's anniversary by creating some reality hopping Wolverines. No.
So I don't even know if you needed this to exist, and you could have just done the Weapon X-Men series as its own thing, which, if you're a big fan of the Earth X receding hairline beard-bellied Wolverine, you're in for a treat for those four issues.
When I'm having writer's block and sometimes getting close to the ending of something I've written, I always Freeze type the following line, and then the sun went Nova. That's what happened here.
I think this is a perfect comic because it now exists as a benchmark for the danger of nostalgia. Like there, but for the grace of God, go we. Maybe there's too much of a good thing sometimes.
There is that old adage of every issue is someone's first, right? And this one, I'm like, oh, wow. I considered, so this is the second to last episode of Silver Age. I considered ending my show with this year because it's Silver Age, but we're instead ending with Marvel's number two, which is an Alex Ross, Kurt Busiek original X-Men story that's beautiful and so resonant. And I wish that that's what this had been. But it's still really fun. It's a fun, crazy, wonky adventure. I think I would have liked it a lot better had Onslaught not shown up at all. That was a weird turn for me. Onslaught's always a difficult concept on its own, and they just bring him back again and again. Frank, can we expect Onslaught in X-Men 97 season 2?
You know, I can neither confirm nor deny the presence of that entity, but I think it's safe to say we'll be, it'll be clear horizon.
One of the resonant things that stands out here for me is Angel's very brief speech about how when we give up in the face of despair and we slowly become that thing we always hated, in this post-Trump election world, we have some crazy shit that's going to happen in the next few years. It's a divisive time. I am 46 years old, and I've gone through some major changes on an internal level as a queer man who grew up in a conservative religious culture. You know, the lines are drawn pretty clear, but I'm not going to lose sight of like hope and humanity in the face of all that. I won't become the thing that they said that we're, you know, I'm overstretching that thought, but don't lose. That's the thing I take from this, is don't become the thing that you always stated you wouldn't be, or the thing that you want to rise up against. So that's what I'll carry with me as a result of this.
When I read that line, I thought for sure that this, when I said, was this written after the election?
I mean, I've got a thought, which is there are a lot of terrible people out there who are currently trying to brainwash you every single day. You can resist it. And when we develop brainwashing technology, we should use it as aggressively as possible with no moral compunction whatsoever. Throw our ethics out the window, I say.
You know, to tie it back to this issue, and every issue being their first, you know, I know, at least kid me, the one thing that I loved about the Marvel Universe is that I was kind of just jumping into one moment in time. But what Christos does at the end of this, instead of putting the little captions, the editor captions throughout the issue, he just gives you a little reference on where he drew from at the end of it.
I love a glossary page. I do love a glossary page.
Yes. Where there's just, for me as a kid, what I loved about the Marvel Universe is that there were things that happened before me, and the excitement was learning about that history and discovering it and tracking stuff down. So this pours a lot of Marvel, you know, thoughts and ideas from various different time periods and series all into one issue. I hope that if this is somebody's first issue, that they would be intrigued to be able to explore more and learn about all the other stuff that the Marvel Universe has to offer.
Absolutely. It does give a lot of those Brian Michael Bendis time travel X-Men stories where there's like five versions of each character running around. I have about 700 Silver Age X-Men stories that I hope to write and publish one day. None of them involve Onslaught or the Phoenix Force. I'll just Okay, as we're wrapping up, I'd love to hear from each of you where people can find you online. Do you have any final thoughts? And is there anything you'd like to plug? We're going to put this out on December 23rd. Let's go Brent, Frank, and then Glenn.
Sure. You can find us on Instagram at Homospirit Podcast, where we post tons of memes. All of our issues come out every Friday, anywhere podcasts are available. We also have tons of great bonus issues on different series like Madam Web or Creator Crushes with writers like Leah Williams. So you should check all that fun stuff out. Coming up soon, we're going to have our best and worst of 2024. It's probably leaning a little bit more heavy on one side than the other, but it should be a fun episode. So check that out.
You can follow me on all social media at Happy Go Jackie, GH Mini Spotlight. It's a GH after show where we talk about all the ins and outs of General Hospital. I've been doing that for almost 10 years. So there you go. If you love the soap opera General Hospital, we love talking about it as well. And then also we're just plugging away at X-Men 97 season 2. It can't come soon enough, but it's going to be longer than we all want it to take before it gets to everybody's screens.
I grew up with five sisters watching All My Children and One Life to Live every day after school. I was never a General Hospital head, but if you ever want to talk One Life to Live in the 80s and 90s, man, I'm your man.
Oh, man. David Canary. Signature. He's the best.
Frank, I say as a fan, I would really like you to stop doing interviews, and could you please get on that season? I need it to come out.
All right, bye, everybody. Gotta go.
Yeah, Frank, I'll let my wife know about the what you're doing with General. She's a big fan. I was a fan back in the 80s with the Luke and Laura stuff, but then I left after the Weather Machine went to pieces. So.
Those Cassadines.
Those Cassadines. what I'm doing these days, Chad, it's kind of out of the realm of the creative world. I'm starting an app, believe it or not. It's called Hadom, H-A-D-O-M. It stands for Have a Drink on Me. So if you guys walked into a bar that had the software in their POS system, you'd get a notification. It says, hey, Chad, you've just walked into a Hadom bar. Would you like to let your friends know? So they can either A, they could join you, or B, they can buy you a drink. So you'd let them know, yeah, sure. And then I would get a notification, Chad just walked into a Hadom bar. You want to buy him a drink? I said, that was a great podcast that I did with Chad. I'm going to buy him a drink, and you would get to accept it. And so hopefully, I was hoping it would be out before the holidays. It doesn't look like till it's going to be maybe January.
That's really fun. I can't wait to hear more. Where can people follow you?
Right now, they can go to Hadom.com. That's where I'm that's where I'm working. I'm trying to stay off social media. You can understand why. So.
yeah. My brain is reeling, Glenn. I had all my interview questions prepped, but somehow we covered Liren and Black Wolf, but not Cable. We'll get there next time. I can't wait to have you back on sometime, my friend. Thank you, everybody, for listening. It's been such a joy to produce this show over the last 3.5 years. And reaching the end of the Silver Age just feels like a major career milestone in a weird, odd way. We get to launch into the new year with a massive script reading of Giant Size X-Men number one, as well as a celebration of Krakoa and a celebration of the life of Len Wein. So be ready as we move into new territory in the new year. Same show, new tune, new logo, new format. So I'm really excited to share that all with you. We've been working on it for a long time. Thanks everybody for listening. Thank you, Glenn. Thank you, Frank. Thank you, Brent. We will see you all back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane. Thank you for listening to Gray Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Gray Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Gray Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane.